How many socialists we got out there tonight? Come on, let's see a show of left hands. You drive here on a public street, socialist. You go to a public school, socialist. You ever visit a public library? Why? I'll tell you why, because you're a socialist. Like Ulysses S. Grant. Yellowstone National Park. You ever been there? Yeah, you're a socialist. Like Teddy Pinko Roosevelt. That guy was talking about universal health care. You're a taxating, appropriating, regulating, nanny stating socialist. I remember when my dog got run over by a truck. And the socialist animal control people came and picked up my dog. Then my neighbor's house caught on fire and the socialist fire department came and put it out. Snatched up that dog and cooked it on my neighbor's house. Another good meal ruined by socialism. You ever mail a letter? Of course you have, because you're a socialist. Like Dwight D. Eisenhower. That guy built highways between the states. Yeah, you're a socialist. Like Richard Red Diaper Nixon. Put food stamps on people's plates. Yeah, you're a taxating, appropriating, regulating, nanny stating socialist. How many socialists does it take to screw in a light bulb? Too many. To requisition the light bulb, 4 more to process the requisition in triplicate, 8 to manufacture the light bulb, 3 to subsidize the manufacturing, 3 to procure the light bulb, 2 to supervise the manufacturing and procurement process, 7 to warehouse the light bulb for an indeterminate length of time, 4 to deliver the light bulb to the wrong address, 4 more to re-deliver the light bulb, 6 to receive the light bulb, and 1 to screw it up. 47. How many capitalists does it take to screw in a light bulb? 2. 1 impoverished nation willing to exploit its malnourished population and rape its natural resources to manufacture, package, and deliver the light bulb to Walmart. And me. You know why that's funny? Because you're a socialist. Like Ronald W. Reagan, earned income tax credit. Yeah, you're a socialist. Like George W. SSR Bush. That guy wrote the book on government interference. Of course, he never read it. You're a taxating, appropriating, regulating, nanny stating, Stalin hugging, Castro kissing, Marx belating, spawn of Satan, socialist. Every last.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program, everything you wanted to know about drone warfare but were afraid to ask. They begin by discussing what are drones and the history of their use. Avery Plouffe defends their use. David Koh criticizes the Obama administration for using them. Gregory Johnson claims that drone casualties were driving Yemeni people towards Al-Qaeda.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for all of our audience members for being with us tonight. I'm Associate Professor of Political Science here at the college and the Director of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program. And as Tom said, what we want to do just to make sure that we're all on the same page before we start our discussion of how advised or ill-advised drone usage is to make sure everybody understands what drones are, when they began to be used, in what numbers, in what countries, etc. So I have a few questions that I'll direct to Avery Plaw in his in his capacity as the editor of the drone database that Tom referred to, and then we'll move on, as Tom said, to each speaker having 10 to 15 minutes to lay out their position, then I'll moderate a discussion among them, and then we'll finish with hopefully as much as half an hour's worth of questions from the audience. Okay, my first question, very basic. What is a drone and how does it work?
Drone is a bee, a male bee without a stinger, whose job is to have sex with the queen bee and is not responsible for gathering honey. But more typically these days, the term drone is used to refer to a family of unmanned aircraft that are guided by a remote control. So drones really refer to a whole class of airplanes that are controlled from a distance, often from the far side of the world these days, places like Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. You'll also hear the term UAV, unmanned aerial vehicle, or the Air Force prefers the term RPA for remotely piloted aircraft. But all these terms are really referring to the same family of remote-controlled planes. And actually, it's a pretty diverse family, with a few members who have recently achieved great celebrity. The biggest current military drone is the Global Hawk, with a wingspan of 116 feet, weighing over 25,000 pounds when fueled, and it acts as a high-altitude surveillance drone. At the other end of the spectrum, there is the RQ-11 Raven, which is about the size of a model airplane, weighs about 4.2 pounds, and is launched by soldiers by hand. But the most famous drone, the workhorse of the fleet, is the MQ-1 Predator, which is 27 feet long, wingspan just under 50 feet, weighing around 1,000 pounds. It's a slow, propeller-driven craft that flies at about 85 miles an hour and can stay in the air for up to 40 hours. The drones are used for surveillance and also have been armed now for attack. The Predators carry infrared cameras, normal television cameras, and laser designators, which allow them to attack with great precision. The Predators are typically armed with AGM-114 Hellfire missiles, which are a kind of anti-tank missile. The missiles are around 64 inches and weigh about 100 pounds, and they can take out a tank. Often they're used to take out cars. In the last year or a little more, the Predator drones have also been armed with a smaller Scorpion missile, about 21 inches long, weighs 35 pounds, and is designed to make a very compact explosion to avoid collateral damage. And the Predator has recently been joined by a larger cousin, which is also deployed now, the MQ-9 Reaper, which is about a third longer, third larger wingspan, but can carry seven times the payload, including much heavier munitions like the GBU-12 Paveway Guided Bomb.
When did drones start being used to drop bombs as opposed to for reconnaissance missions, and which U.S. government agencies target them?
The Predators were initially used as reconnaissance and surveillance vehicles starting in the war in Bosnia in 1995 and were found to be very useful. They weren't armed until shortly after September 11th, and they were used initially in the invasion of Afghanistan, where they had some successes, for example, taking out Mohammed Atef, the Al-Qaeda number 3 at the time.
And which U.S. government agencies use them?
The drone strikes in Pakistan are run primarily by the CIA, while in Yemen, Somalia, the military, particularly JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, plays a much larger role.
Which countries have been the primary targets of drone strikes, and how many drone strikes are recorded in those countries?
Okay, the American drones have been used in conventional theaters of war, such as Afghanistan and Iraq, and also in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and there are some reports of them being used in the Philippines as well. There is a diversity of opinion on the exact numbers involved, but I can give you some ranges. So strikes in Pakistan probably are somewhere in between 365 at this point and 420 strikes. There are at least 43 to 53 strikes in Yemen and probably considerably more. At least 3 to 9 in Somalia. The numbers in Libya are fuzzier, but there is at least one strike that was confirmed by the Pentagon, and some reports suggest that there were quite a few during the civil war with Gaddafi's forces. At any rate, the great majority of the strikes, as you can see, have been in Pakistan.
And finally, what do we know about the cost of drone strikes, either per strike, or are there separate budgets that we have public knowledge of the CIA and military, or how do we assess the cost?
We have some knowledge about the money that's being spent on drones. Since 2001, the U.S. military has spent more than $26 billion on drones. It plans to continue spending $5 billion a year. And in August 2011, they announced that they would invest another $23 billion in drone development. Predator drones cost about $4 million each, and Hellfire missiles around $25,000 each. The U.S. military has procured more than 250 MQ-1 Predator drones and has 65 advanced MQ-9 Reapers and has ordered 400 more. And the CIA has some as well, but we don't know how many. In 2000, the U.S. had only 50 drones, but today it has over 7,500, although the majority are the smaller Ravens that I mentioned. Still, it's about close to a third of all warplanes.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Great. Thank you very much for that introduction. And now we'll start with the positions of each of our speakers. We'll start first with Professor David Cole.
Thank you. So as many of you probably know, Senator Rand Paul, spent 13 hours on the Senate floor last week talking about drones. And Tom said that we each of us had to stay under that 13-hour times period for ours. I thought I would also start with some facts. This is a report that I just pulled off of the internet. It's a report of a University of Minnesota poll that finds that the majority of Americans are opposed to being killed by drones. And the poll found, the poll, which has a margin of error of plus or minus 5 percentage points, according to this report, showed that 97% of those surveyed strongly agreed with the statement, "I personally do not want to be killed by a drone." With 3% answering, "Don't know, no opinion." And then, as you always have to do with these polls, they interviewed an expert from the University of Minnesota who explained that the idea of being killed by a drone is not playing well out there. And then they did a focus group, and one member of the focus group said, "You know, it doesn't even seem like the government is trying to come up with alternatives to killing us with drones. It seems like they could figure out some kind of system where instead of just killing us by a drone, people could maybe present evidence to see if they're guilty or not." And then Jay Carney responded to this. White House spokesman responded to this by saying, "Look, people are afraid of getting killed by a drone. We get that. But there is still broad public support for drones killing somebody else." That was Andy Borowitz in The New Yorker reporting on a fictitious poll. But I think it underscores one important point about the public debate in the United States on this subject, and that is that there is much greater concern about the notion that the president can kill one of us by pushing a button or by ordering someone to push a button or authorizing someone to push a button without trial, charges, or an opportunity to present evidence and determine whether he's guilty or not, than there is with respect to the use of drones to kill Pakistanis, Yemenis, Somalis, and Afghans. But I think the practice raises legal, political, and ethical concerns, whoever the victims are, whether the victims are us or the victims are them. Now, I want to start by suggesting that the drone issue, sometimes it's referred to these days as Obama's Guantanamo. Of course, Obama still has Guantanamo, but Obama's Guantanamo in the sense that just as Guantanamo for President Bush was a terrible headache and created lots of resentment and anti-Americanism around the world, so too that's the case with drones today. And of course, the Guantanamo concern, much of the concern about Guantanamo was the concern about torture and the way we treated people who were detained at Guantanamo. I think there's a basic difference between torture and drone strikes. Torture is simply not permissible. It's not permissible under international law. It's not permissible under constitutional law. No exceptions, including in time of war. Killing, by contrast, is a part of war. It's not a very nice part of war, but it's a necessary part of war. It's an inevitable part of war. It's not an illegal part of war. And targeted killing is better than untargeted killing. So why, then, is there so much concern about drones around the world, and particularly in those countries where we are deploying them? And I think There are concern that is akin to the concern that was raised about George Bush's use of torture to interrogate people. And I think it's a number of factors. One is the secrecy surrounding this program. So, yes, we are killing people by pushing buttons, but we don't even acknowledge that we're doing it. Anwar al-Awlaki, the U.S. citizen who was killed in Yemen, he was killed in October, September 2011. But the United States has still not acknowledged that it killed him. It essentially killed him in secret and continues officially to deny that it played that role. So, and the whole architecture around the drone policy still remains significantly secret. So there's this remarkable power that the United States is able to employ and is employing, and it does so in secret, not acknowledging that it's doing it, and not setting forth in any public way the rules that guide it. Second, and relatedly, it reflects a kind of American exceptionalism. Because would we accept the practice of drone killing if it was Russia killing alleged Chechen terrorists with drones around Eastern Europe and just denying that it was engaged in it, doing it on the basis of a secret policy and making general statements about how they have the right to defend themselves? No, we wouldn't accept that. And yet, we're willing, we, the American people, who have not risen up in revolt against this practice, are willing to accept it if it's America that's doing it. I don't think the United States as a nation would accept a world in which each country was armed with drones and was deploying them under the terms that we are deploying them today. So there's this sense that we're doing it in this way because we can and because, at least for the moment, we have a monopoly on it. Third, there is the issue of the scope of war, right? It's not controversial to use a drone to kill somebody on the battlefield in Afghanistan who is fighting against us. Nobody suggests you can't kill people who are fighting against you in an ongoing armed conflict. But when you start to use drones thousands of miles away from the battlefield and to use them in contexts that are outside of that kind of traditional armed conflict, there begins to raise the question of, you know, are we engaged in a war with al-Qaeda, or are we engaged in some kind of global war on terror, as President Bush initially articulated it? President Obama rejected that term, but the sort of scope of the drone policy sometimes suggests that any terrorist threat we see out there who poses some kind of threat of attacking us, we can, instead of arresting him, bringing him to justice, we can kill him with a drone using a kind of war authority. And that seems deeply troubling to the rest of the world. And then the fourth factor, I think, is the ease with which drones make it possible to eliminate a human being. They make it easy to kill. They make it easy to use lethal force in ways that are, I think, really radically different. You know, some people say, oh, you know, drones is just another technological development in fighting wars. And, you know, bows and arrows made it easier to kill people than bayonets, and rifles made it easier than bow and arrows, and catapults made it easier than, you know, hand-to-hand combat, and planes made it easier. And this is just another. But I think not. I think that the thing about drones is, because they are so they can be targeted remotely, because they can be targeted very precisely, you can use lethal force without putting any single American life at risk, without putting any boots on the ground, without invading in any obvious physical way the sovereignty of another territory. You can do it in ways that don't create the risk of significant civilian casualties, innocent civilians, which bombs, less surgically precise bombs, create. And you can do it in quote-unquote plausibly deniable ways. It's hard to deny when you drop a big bomb on a country. But if you target an individual, take out that individual, it's a little bit easier to deny. And so it's taken away the disincentives to go to lethal force as a response to problems. There were a lot of disincentives before. I think drones have eliminated many of them. This makes it all the more critical that we have some kind of clear set of legal rules that are acceptable, not only in the United States, but around the world, that would regularize and justify and constrain the use of this tactic. And right now, we don't have that, or we don't know whether we have that, because of the secrecy surrounding the program. What we know about the program comes from speeches that Obama administration officials have given, in which they've given very broad outlines of the program, but not the details. And of course, the devil is in the details. Sometimes I think, you know, trying to figure out what the drone policy is in the United States is a little bit like what the Sovietologists during the Soviet Union, who tried to, you know, determine what Soviet policy was by looking at who was in the picture of the Politburo and, you know, who was standing in front and who was standing behind. I mean, and that shouldn't be the case in a democracy, that we have to guess at what our government's authority to kill, including killing us, is. So I think the biggest problem with the drone program is precisely its secrecy. I'll just briefly mention two other problems and then sit down so that we have more time for discussion. But the two other problems are imminence and feasibility. So what the government has said in a leaked document has said that they have the authority to kill, again, even Americans who they see as an operational leader of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces who pose an imminent threat of attack on us and who it's not feasible to capture. And they're relying there, with respect to that imminence and feasibility of capture language, on the notion of self-defense. A nation is authorized to use lethal force under international law against another nation that attacks it in an armed way, or a non-state actor like Al-Qaeda that attacked us on 9/11. We can use military force against them. We can also use military force against an imminent attack. But the critical requirement of imminence is designed to ensure that this is the last resort, that force is the last resort. Because if the attack's not imminent, there may be a way to head it off other than using lethal force. And so the law requires that this be the only option, the last option. Well, Anwar al-Awlaki was put on the kill list a year before he was killed. So it can't possibly have been that he posed an imminent threat when he was put on the kill list, because it went a year without him attacking us. And when he was killed, he wasn't in the business of engaging in any immediate attack on us. He was driving somewhere. So what have they said? They've said, well, anybody of that ilk, an operational leader who wants to attack us and might attack us at any time, by definition poses an imminent threat. And therefore, the imminence criterion is satisfied. But the problem with that is, if they're not actually engaged in an immediate attack against us, then it might well be that if we can't capture them today, we can capture them tomorrow. The third concern, so secrecy, imminence, and then feasibility. If you can't capture, you can kill. If you can capture, you should bring the person to justice, give him a trial, et cetera, et cetera. But what does it mean to say that it's not feasible to capture somebody like Anwar al-Awlaki, who's in Yemen? I mean, if we sent enough troops into Yemen, we could probably capture Anwar al-Awlaki. If we supported Yemen in trying to capture Anwar al-Awlaki, we might well be able to capture him. Apparently, they tried once to capture him and did not succeed. But we don't generally think that if the cops come to your house to arrest you and you're not there, that now they're free to just shoot you, right? We try again to arrest. So the feasibility of capture criterion raises questions, particularly when capture might actually put American lives at risk, but pushing that button on the drone puts no American lives at risk. I think it's absolutely critical that we resolve these questions in a fair and legitimate reason. And I think that for a number of reasons. First, because what we do will be a precedent for what the rest of the world does, and I don't think we want to live in a world in which the rest of the world feels free to engage in drone attacks in the way that we have done. Secondly, because I think they cause a tremendous amount of resentment and anti-Americanism out there. They are a recruiting tool for the enemy, and that's not in our interest. Third, because I don't think you can have a concept of democracy where the president can kill any of us in secret without acknowledging that he has done so under a secret set of rules. That is just inconsistent to me with the notion of limited government and democracy. And then fourth, because, as I suggested earlier, drones make it so easy to kill, I think it is an ethical and moral issue that we create a set of constraints on this new and very scary power. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Our next speaker will be Avery Plaugh.
David raises excellent points, and I am going to ignore them for now. In the interest of generating debate, what I'll try to do is lay out a positive case for the use of drones, at least in certain circumstances, and then we can litigate the details of the proper definition of imminence, for example, in the question and answer period afterwards. So tonight, I'll argue that drone strikes against individual known terrorists who pose an imminent threat and cannot otherwise be neutralized are good and defensible policy. However, I will also argue that some types of strikes, notably what are called signature strikes, are actually counterproductive and should stop. So that's the position that I'm going to defend today. And I'll do that by outlining five arguments for drones. First, their effectiveness. Second, the safety of operators. Third, their discrimination. Fourth, the lack of alternatives. And fifth, I'll venture into the gray area of legality as best I can. And I'll argue that they are legal at least when they take the form of personality strikes, although I'll suggest that signature strikes are problematic.
And now for something completely different.